Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. If there is such a thing as the American literary canon, then Percival Everett is at the center of it. The author of over 30 novels, books of poetry and short fiction, and children's literature. For over 30 years, Everett has been one of the great innovators of fictional forms. A reader of Everett's is just as likely to encounter a Western as a pastiche of academic discourse, and all wrapped up in a blistering comedic novel. Everett has never shied away from having it both ways. He is a writer of precision and care with language and postmodern metaplay, who takes those aesthetics into satirical romps, mysteries, and in the case of his most recent acclaimed novel, The Trees, a police procedural in the vein of Chester Himes. Perhaps the most distinguishing element of Everett's fiction has been his unwavering truth-telling when it comes to the still open wounds of racism in America. In our interview, we discuss how a novel about the history and present of racial violence, from the beginnings of lynching during Reconstruction to the present-day killings of unarmed black men and women by police officers, means something different in the Trump era. We open up the question of whether or not literary arts are capable of being catalysts to the kinds of change that other movements have failed to enact. And Everett talks about the importance of an adapting and growing archive of the names of those killed in lynchings or extrajudicial killings, a list of names that he has himself attempted to write down as an act of remembering. For those of you who don't already know and love Percival Everett, you've got a wonderful library of reading in front of you. I'm excited to share our interview. Let's start the show. Welcome back to Burned by Books. It is an intimidating thing to introduce Professor Percival Everett. His CV looks like the accumulated work of three men. Percival has 22 novels to his name, and that doesn't include his collections of short stories or his poetry, children's literature, or criticism. His many awards and fellowships include a Guggenheim, the Penn Oakland Award, the Hurst and Wright Legacy Award, Penn Center USA Fiction Award, the Dos Passos Prize, and the Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, just to name a few. He is currently Distinguished Professor of English at USC. While I cannot possibly claim to have read even a majority of his novels, I've taught erasure for many years now, and it is exemplary of what is most remarkable about Percival's fiction. Its refusal to be any one thing. One of our great chroniclers of the complications and catastrophes of race in the United States, his novels work to unseat and demystify many of the assumptions about how power and capital are leveraged via absolute positions on the nature of blackness and whiteness. A chameleon in his voices and forms, Percival's novels are never the same tone or mood or vantage from one to the next. If there's a particular stylistic that announces his work, it is the steel-tipped boot to what is considered commonplace knowledge or the agreed-upon status quo. He takes on the sacred cows of culture, art, and politics, and always with a satirical bite that leaves a mark. It is impossible to talk about Percival's work without describing its sine qua non humor. Percival has a density of jokes and language play and absurdity in his novels to rival the best of prestige TV comedy. Think HBO's South Side, but with a heaping helping of dread always following any joke. And that gets me to the purpose of our conversation today, discussing his newest novel, The Trees, a story of the nation's history of lynchings and its continued failure to address those past evils and their present manifestations. The Trees takes up with two black special officers who travel from Hattiesburg to Money, Mississippi, to investigate a series of murders of white men whose bodies are nearly decapitated by barbed wire and castrated. Beyond the gruesomeness of the crimes is the supernatural seeming appearance and disappearance of the badly disfigured body of a black man who is found holding the genitals of the dead white men. There is even the suggestion that this disappearing body might be the ghost of Emmett Till, returned to take justice against those who killed him. If this description doesn't sound like a howler of a book, you probably haven't read any Percival Everett. The Trees is one of the funniest things I read all year, even if that humor feels like it comes with a cost. Ed and Jim, our special investigators, crack jokes about a Mississippi that seems not to have moved an inch from the 1930s, or as one character remarks, the 1830s. The officers wonder aloud in joking tones whether a white police officer who pulls them over might shoot them. Every joke in the book is followed swiftly by a slap in the face. The Trees is ultimately about the question of what kind of justice is possible in the world we've made from every manner of racist structure. Can a true archive of those who have been lynched or killed without reason be a form of justice? Or does the strange fruit of Billie Holiday's song of lynching become the seeds for bloody revolution? It is an honor to welcome Percival Everett to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Hope I can live up to that introduction.
Thank you so much for being here. I want to start just by digging directly into the substantive core of the novel, which is thinking about lynching and its current manifestations. There is an older website, which is called Without Sanctuary, that catalogs photographs that were taken of lynchings and often horrifyingly repurposed as postcards or keepsakes by the white men and their families that came to watch these killings. In The Trees, Mama Z, a 105-year-old woman, has created her own catalog of every known lynching since the day she was born. Your novel is possessed with the idea of an archive of those killings, one that includes police killings in the 21st century. What does such an archive mean to you, and why did you want it to be the core of the novel?
Well, just the idea that history gets written, as the cliche goes, by the victors. I don't know if that needs to persist. When we archive the world, we retain it. It's hard to ignore the crimes when there is a record. History will write itself, and as we know, it often is wrong. And that's where art comes in. Whereas there may be nothing factual in a novel, it may well be true. Likewise, in history or current events even, I can give you many, many facts that are in fact correct, but no truth has been rendered. So that's what's behind writing a novel about this.
Yes, I'm thinking of the well-reported aspect of the concentration camps in which prison guards, German prison guards, told the people of the camps that they would not be remembered and their names would not be recorded.
Yes.
And I feel so much like that's going on here.
Of course.
The cover of The Trees is a haunting palimpsest of the names of real lynching victims. A character in the novel becomes obsessed with the idea of writing down each name from the archive of injustice and then erasing them to set them free. Were you at all interested in a kind of enacting of your own form of this kind of naming?
Well, naming is tremendously important to us as a species. And I think and that's true across the board of all cultures. And the writing down of things may well be more important to those of us in the West. But for me, the writing down of the names, and I did this. I did what the character in the novel does, and I did write down pages and pages of names. I did not do what he does in the end, which is to erase them, which I do see as a final act of freeing the individual from being a mere statistic.
And in erasing them, how does that change their statisticness?
They don't serve anyone anymore. I realized as I was writing the names down, as much as it affected me, that there is an element of my using those names for my own understanding of the world. They've paid enough.
Hmm. The trees hold many ideas and moods and genres in tension. It's a Southern Gothic, a police noir, a satire. It's at times break your ribs funny, horrifyingly macabre, while offering a brutal assessment of the wages of historical sin. That tension between these dissonant ways of experiencing a story, I find to be a hallmark of much of your work. How did you develop this style, and do you find that it evolves and mutates depending on the subject matter?
Well, the novel tells me how it should be written. I can't say that I've developed a particular style that might even suggest that I understand it enough to teach it, which I don't. What I do understand is that every story has its own voice. If I do have a strength, is that I or a talent, it's that I allow the story the voice it needs to tell itself. But I have no tricks, and I have no particular tools that allow me to employ this when I want to.
Were there particular authors when you were first beginning to write fiction that you looked to and you found, if not things to borrow, at least a certain kind of inspiration in the way that their form and structures brought forth the subject of their work?
Oh, so many. I always mention and so it must be true. Lawrence Stern's The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy it has been enormously influential to me, as well as Samuel Butler's The Way of All Flesh and Erewhon, Chester Himes, and the movement of story of Zora Neale Hurston and things like Their Eyes Were Watching God. So I find, and even works that I, and of course I can't leave out Mark Twain, who probably has done more to shape my sense of humor than most writers. It's reading everything that affects the voice in which I write, even when it doesn't look like the thing that I'm using. In my novel, God's Country, which is a parody of the Western, I wanted to create a language that sounded like the Western, but that I couldn't find any place else. And in order to do that, I had to learn another language. So I watched some 150 really bad pulp Westerns and read as many novels until I owned it enough that I could change it.
Hmm. I love that. And here in The Trees, we've got a police procedural slash noir that has a very particular kind of style of conversation and way of speaking, especially between the police officers and FBI agent. What was your prep like for that kind of dialogue?
I think all of that, you and I and everyone else, we've sort of taken that in. We know that. I watched every night for the time I was writing this, the old Perry Mason television show, and all of those noir films, and the Big Sleep and Maltese Falcon. That rhythm, we know it very well, in the same way that we watch at movies knowing the formula. And the disruption of that formula is where, as an artist, I can get a lot of mileage.
Mm-hmm. There's a moment in which Mama Z tells Damon, who's a University of Chicago professor that the waitress Gertrude has lured down to Money, Mississippi, that his work on racial violence is scholarly and that he has constructed it without an ounce of outrage. I feel like this novel wants to show what happens when the outrage of hundreds of years of unanswered murder and violence builds to the breaking point. Do you think the novel form is capable of handling outrage well? And by that, I mean, I feel like that sort of violence that explodes out of outrage, in some way, art can contain it a little bit, even as it shows us its possibilities and its frightening potential outcomes.
Two things. First, art can only do so much. The fact that we can have a national public outrage for 10 days and then forget whatever it was that made us upset is alarming. And it happens all the time. One story supplants another. So there's a kind of an attention deficit disorder that our culture practices that in a way doesn't allow art or the news to affect our long-term outrage about anything. That's a great sadness for me. The other thing is that let me see if I can phrase this in some way. When you sell a novel, you have to realize that you're not affecting that many people. It would be nice. It would be nice if literary novels were on sale in the aisle at the grocery store, along with the candy bars and everything else, and people would just pick them up. But if you sell, let's say, 50,000 novels, which is a lot of novels, you're doing fantastically. If I were to make a CD of music, that's how old I am. I talk about CDs.
me too.
of music and sold 50,000 units, I would never record again. Literature is not at the center of our culture's artistic gaze. And part of my job is to position it better. I'm failing miserably, but I'm still trying.
Do you feel like that because many of your, I would call all of your novels that I've read quite literary in the sense of the conventions of aesthetic beauty and the care with language, but you're almost always, as you say, borrowing and changing aspects of what might have been called, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, genre fiction. Do you think by doing that, there's any way that you're expanding the novel's purview, giving it a little bit more of that supermarket aisle possibility?
Apparently not. No, I don't think about that. I don't think about audience at all either. I just try to tell the story. If my line about thinking about audience, who are you writing for? People will ask me, and I say, I have to write for myself. There are as many ways to read a story as there are people to read it. And if I think about pleasing anyone, then I'm frozen. So I'm just trying to entertain myself and have fun with the philosophical ideas that haunt me.
I wanted to follow up on this idea of our short attention span, and that is thinking about the era of George Floyd, which has brought to prominence actually many, many major academic works on systematic racial violence. They have been matched with a movement, principally BLM, but other other components joining it, that is ordered but also outraged. Still together, as you said, these two forces have not managed to change a single law on policing or voting or the treatment of race in schools. And this may be partially about that short attention span or something else. Is it revolution that comes next in your mind? Certainly that's where the novel leads us, or perhaps to a period of worsening violence and vigilantism.
I'm not an exponent for violence of any kind. The current atmosphere of this country is there are a lot of you know, racists have their swag back. I'll put it that way. It used to be that, and I, when I say used to be, I mean maybe 30 years ago, that it, even racists understood that their behavior was abhorrent and would try to hide it. Yeah, but they, and they would be racist and they would do racist things, but they understood the behavior was objectionable. With the introduction of a certain figure into our culture, it's no longer considered abhorrent behavior. It's, we're racist and we're proud. Now, that has always existed in a very small minority in the culture. At one point, it was a great majority, but through much of my second half of my adulthood, at least there was a pretense that there was an understanding that such behavior was wrong. That seems to be gone for a lot of people now. Violence, unfortunately, small-minded people, such as the people I'm talking about, are prone to violence because they are desperate and they feel helpless. They're uneducated, and that doesn't mean they haven't gone to college. That just means they're uneducated. They haven't been trained to think, and their desires in the world to use what they have learned is fairly one-dimensional. How can I get richer? How can I stand on the shoulders of someone else? It's not a good thing. But I am a fiction writer. I'm a novelist. To look to me for any kind of wisdom about the world is, I mean, I've chosen to write fiction for a living. That's evidence enough that I'm intellectually and deficient. But so I just make the art. It'll do what it does in the world, and we'll see what happens.
Well, one of the things that it does do is take up what is the incredible irony of race. That is that bioanthropologists have for decades, if not longer, understood race as a cultural construct. And yet it's impossible to understand any aspect of American life or history outside of the preeminence of race. You satirize the idea of being black enough or too black. Why have you been so drawn to this contradiction of race as both a construct and an absolute?
Well, as you say, there is not a work of art created in the United States of America that is not influenced by the idea of race. Even a work that claims that it is not has chosen to ignore something that affects everyone in this country, and therefore it is a statement about some kind of racial existence and within this society. It's a bogus category that exists. That's fascinating to me. There is no such thing as race, but it affects everything we do in the United States and therefore the world. That's fascinating. On a purely intellectual level, that's a wonderful puzzle.
Yeah, and it's a puzzle you certainly play with in many of your novels. And I wonder if you feel like art is the thing that allows us to maybe move past that that contradiction. Is there a way to understand that both things are true, but also to for art to take up the abstract nature of this construction of race that's different than the way we're dealing with it now in political spheres?
I don't know. I'm just a dumb writer. It's certainly the case that we've conflated the idea of race with the idea of difference. People say that they're colorblind, and that's bullshit. That makes no sense at all to me. If somebody robs you, you describe him, and one of the descriptors might well be his or her color. That's not racist in and of itself. We appear differently in the world. I'll describe the color of someone's hair to the police if they've taken my laptop. That's fine. But it's the idea that to get past racism, one has to get past seeing people that gets in the way of honest interrogation.
Your character Gertrude, who I'll admit to have sort of fallen in love with reading the book, she's such an appealing character. She's known hilariously as Dixie at work.
Appears, I'll give her your number.
Appears to some as white and some as black. A policeman says she may have a drop in her, with the assumption being that a drop of black blood makes you black. And we later learn that a key white character was the product of an affair with a black man who was himself later lynched. How does the concept of mixing and mixed race complicate the irony of racial constructs in your work?
Well, I grew up in the South, and everybody's mixed. So there's a wonderful story about Pitchfork Ben Tillman, who was a racist politician in the state of South Carolina, 19th century. South Carolina is the only Southern state that never adopted the one drop rule. The rule, the one you just mentioned, that if you have one drop of black blood, you are therefore black. In a room at the University of South Carolina, he told other like-minded racist South Carolinians that they could never adopt that rule. And they couldn't, because if they did, not one of them would be able to own land. So there was an admission even there that everyone, at least in the South, was probably mixed. There is such a range of appearance of Black Americans, and often people are, 23 and me. People discover all sorts of things they didn't know. it's bad science, but at least it has people thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, I remember very vividly Oprah discovering that she was not of Zulu ancestry, and it being a real devastation to the sort of story that she, you know, and her family told of themselves. And similarly, I think your South Carolina historical anecdote shows us that those stories that we tell each other, especially about race, are so much more complicated.
Let's back up. She thought she had Zulu heritage.
I believe that was the case. I think that was the controversy.
Wow. I guess she never looked at a map.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But, you know, there worse things can be said of many of us. For my money, I think you stand with maybe a handful of writers as one of the funniest American novelists. I think of you alongside Paul Beattie, Kevin Wilson, Marcy Damansky, Gary Steingart, and a few others who are truly in control of their humor in fiction. But that humor in your novels, especially in The Trees, is staggering in its satire of systematic racism and racial violence. It conjures almost a nausea with the laughter. In my case, the feeling that I have no business laughing at it. Your two protagonists, Jim and Ed, are black cops trying to survive their visit to Money, Mississippi. And they're constantly bantering in one-liners and puns and put-downs. They're part of a system of unequal justice that might just as well eat them up if they didn't have a small modicum of authority within it. Why did you want Jim and Ed to be the center of the novel and the center of the comedy of the novel?
Well, I have to apologize because I suffer from what we in my house call work amnesia. And I simply don't remember a lot of the decisions I made making it. They seem to be a natural, since they're investigating the crimes, they seem to be sort of naturally placed for me to discuss everything. I think it's probably quite obvious that I was also alluding to Gravedigger Jones and Coffin Ed of the Cotton Comes to Harlem novels of Chester Himes. Maybe not as rough as those guys, but they were in my mind. Yeah, it being the investigators, they get to move around, and that was necessary for the book.
I think it's fascinating that whenever they introduce themselves as the special investigators or special police, they say as an aside, we're cops and we hate cops. And that's a very interesting irony or problem within the book. How do you think about that kind of tension within their own career choice and their own ability to wield power?
Well, I'm a professor and I hate professors. So I think it, if you want to be a good, if you're a good citizen to your society, let's imagine it's 1453. You go and you fight in your battles to keep your small territory alive and afloat. But you find out what soldiers are like in this world, and you don't like them. But you must still do what you can to protect your world and your life. And I think that's often that's how these two characters see their position in the MBI. If they weren't present, there would be no one to stand with.
That's a really illustrative example. I wanted to, moving back to the humor of this novel, I wondered if you would share a little section that I found particularly funny. It's Jim and Ed having discovered a diner in Money, Mississippi that they end up going to many times, and they're served by the intriguing Dixie. Would you read that section, starting with Jim looked at the waitress's name tag?
Jim looked at the waitress's name tag, Dixie. For some reason, I don't think that's your name. And you'd be right, she said. Dixie's get better tips than Gertrude's. Well, Gertrude, you seem appropriately out of place here, Jim said. I'm hoping we seem out of place too. Well said, she said. And what will you have? How's the chili, Jim asked. Do you like chili? Yes, I do. Then you will hate the chili here. Catfish or burger? Cheeseburger, Jim said. Do you like cheese, Gertrude asked. Burger. Wise choice. And what about you? She asked Ed. Catfish. Coming up, she turned and walked back to the kitchen. She's cute, Jim said. May I remind you that we're in Money, Mississippi? Maybe I should say that again. Money, Mississippi. The important part of that word, that is the word Mississippi. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is the 21st century, Jim said. Yeah, well, tell that to those fuckers back there in Trump caps. At least there's some color in this joint. I mean, besides us. Jim looked at the walls. They were covered with photos from the 50s and 60s, and old tin product signs, knee-high soda, blue ribbon biscuit mix. There were also weirdly colorized photographs of Elvis Presley and Billy Graham. So are we cliches too? Jim asked. No, we're dinosaurs, but we're not cliches. Gertrude came back with the food. That was fast, Ed said. Luckily, we'd already caught the catfish, she said. So what are you two doing here in Money? I hate to tell you, but we're cops, Jim said. Why do you hate to tell me? Jim sipped some coffee and put down his mug. Because people either love cops or hate them. It's been my experience that the most interesting people hate them. Hell, I'm a cop and I hate them. Me too, Ed said. I especially hate them. Hate myself too on occasion. So you think I'm interesting, Gertrude said to Jim. Jim caught, looked at Ed, then said, I guess that's right. I'm going to get you some extra fries. I'm telling you to be careful, Ed said. I can't help it if I exude charm. Well, do me and yourself and maybe Dixie there a big favor and try not to do too much exuding. I'll do my best, Jim said. You just control your intake of fatty foods.
Thank you so much. I love this section. It's really funny. It captures that sort of like diner and cop banter so beautifully. But as I mentioned about so much of the humor that you use, there's always this sort of roiling conflict and fear and sometimes disgust underneath. And here what's being discussed, and this is before they feel like they've sort of outed Gertrude as Black herself, but there's this idea that if they're caught in some way kind of romantically inclined towards this waitress, that they could be in real physical trouble. And we're not talking about, you know, 1950, we're talking about the present day. And I wonder if you feel like that's really the sort of present circumstance of a place like Mississippi.
You know, it's a weird world. Yeah, I mean, there's somebody out there who could be upset, and you have to be aware of that. The really strange thing is that most crazy racists have someone Black in their family. They have a cousin who's married to a Black man or a Black woman. It's not unusual to them. Racism is far more complicated than I think it used to be. A lot of it comes down to people wanting to be winners. They want to be right without doing the work. That's why lotteries are so popular, and that's why Donald Trump is popular. A lot of Trump supporters see themselves as unlucky rich people. If things had gone just a different way, they would have been Donald Trump. You know, and he also mirrors their taste. They would live the way he lives. Lotteries are, and this is why these people hate education. They hate universities. They call anyone who is educated elite. It's because you can become rich overnight if you win the lottery. You can't become educated overnight. There's a commitment of time. There's a great deal of thought that goes into the decision to participate in the world in that way. And it's frightening. And I understand a lot of this stuff is just fear. And I try to have compassion for that. It must be terrible to be afraid like that. The fact that they can't understand that when I see blue lights flashing in my rearview mirror, that I'm filled with terror, notwithstanding. It's not a good thing to live in the world with fear. And a lot of these people do. Speaking of that, the reaction to, say, Black Lives Matter amongst Trumpers, I guess that's what they're called, they react against it. Not because with the expression, well, all lives matter. Well, I heard a British comedian actually have something wonderful to say about that. He would say, and I can't remember what it is. I'm paraphrasing and I may be completely in a different realm of metaphor. But if you say that, if you say, save the whales, then the response is, well, what about the minnows? You know, well, when people are going out in ships catching minnows, yes, then maybe that's a valid argument. I don't want, the only thing I want, and the whole idea of white guilt about slavery and Jim Crow, I don't want that. I don't care whether, you know, this is the, I don't care whether anyone feels guilty or not about what's happened to Black people in America. The only thing that I would like is for white people to recognize the feeling that, just for example, that a Black man has when a cop approaches him. Nothing else, just to appreciate the fact that there is fear. Now, that doesn't mean that all cops are bad, but if I told you there was one landmine in a parking lot, would you go into the parking lot? I sort of ranted there. Sorry.
No, you didn't. You didn't. And you gave one of the best explanations of the power of the Trump movement that, frankly, I've heard. And also the irony that people who are clearly deeply afraid and afraid of what their position is in this country cannot see other people's fear or separate themselves from that fear. From, you know, as they dodge their own landmines, unwilling to see that other people are having to step carefully. But I think you described it so well. I don't know if you know that there's an amazing Chicago bookstore, the Seminary Co-op Bookstores.
I do know.
Are you? I love it. I think it's a great place, and I learned that the purchasing director there, Meghna Candler, heard that I was interviewing you, and she was excited to pass along a question about your visual arts career. So this is Meghna's question. I've heard that the publication of The Trees was accompanied by a gallery show of paintings that address and respond to the same subject matter as the novel, Lynching in the U.S. How did your art-making practice as a painter inform your practice as a writer and vice versa? Did the two take shape simultaneously, or did one precede the other? And what was it about the particular and notably difficult subject matter that spurred you to explore it through a variety of mediums?
Well, I when I was finished with the novel, I've been painting for a while, and generally my work is abstract, and I finally embraced that term because I don't like the term non-representational. But I also don't like the term abstract because it suggests that I'm abstracting something, and usually I'm trying to not do that. But with this material, I realized that I wasn't finished with it, and I tried to see if I could abstract, if not. And I didn't use any specific images. I just abstracted specific shapes to my idea of lynching, and so these paintings sort of sprang forth, and I'm lucky. I had a very good gallerist named Margot Ross, who was very encouraging. But she recognized the work immediately, and so we put together the show.
I didn't know about your life as a painter until this question came to me, and then I went online and saw the online gallery shots, and they're really extraordinary paintings, and their abstraction is very powerful, and more, I feel like, direct and angry and mournful than the novel, and I wonder if those are two kinds of ways in which you approach this subject, your novel voice, which has a lot of comedy and lightness mixed with its gruesomeness and sorrow, and then a kind of angry and sorrowful life on the canvas.
I don't know. I just make it and shut up.
Well, we're going to, I'm going to post a link to the gallery on the website. And I really encourage my listeners to look at the paintings because they're a remarkable companion to the novel. Because of your novel, I Am Not Sidney Poitier, but also the way in which he has shown up in other works, including The Trees. I wonder if you would talk, given his recent passing, a little bit about why Poitier is important to you and for your work.
Well, I don't know if I can honestly say that Poitier has been important for my work, but he's a fascinating figure, and obviously a wonderful movie star, and I do mean movie stars. There are those actors who are themselves and just they're large on a screen. Humphrey Bogart, Sidney Poitier, people like Robert De Niro. But at the time of Poitier's emerging as a star, he seems antithetical to the figure that white America would want as a representative for black. He's tall, dark, good looking, and articulate. You know, this after the screen presence of people like Stephen Fetchett and Louise Beavers and those actors who were, I'm sure, fine actors, to have him emerge in this way. But to be the only one is what fascinates me. Why America likes to give a seat to one person from some minority one at a time, it seems. But why Sidney Poitier? Why not Harry Belafonte? More importantly, why not both? Both fine actors, both clearly of African ancestry, both from the islands, and so from the Caribbean. Why one and not the other? Why not both? But there's other actors at the same time. Why only Sidney Poitier? Could America only handle one Black star? So that's fast. That became fascinating to me, and it didn't affect Poitier in ways that I would find objectionable. You know, it didn't make him seeing his being anointed as making him special, which he obviously is anyway. But he was very active in the civil rights movement. He was outspoken. He didn't recede and simply stand by and enjoy the acceptance of white America that he had. So he's a fascinating figure to me.
He's being sort of remembered. I think it's you raise the important point of why he was such the singular Black actor figure at that time, and what that meant.
In fact, I will mention one role of his, and he plays the overseer on a plantation in a film called Band of Angels, which is based on a Robert Penn Warren novel. It stars Clark Gable and Yvonne DiCarlo. The Sidney Poitier that we all know and see, that is made safe and desexualized in films, appears there as a really menacing figure, unlike the Sidney Poitier we see in subsequent work. And it's a remarkable performance. He's very young.
I haven't seen it. I'll have to check it out. It sounds very different from his typical roles, for sure. So I always like to end just asking to hear a little bit about what are the things you're reading right now, and who are you finding inspires you?
Because I'm teaching a semester, I'm teaching a film course on the Western, so I've been rereading The Searchers and another Alan LeMay novel called Painted Ponies. These are Westerns, and I suppose it's work reading because I talk about them in class. But I have a renewed respect for the treatment of Native people in the LeMay novels, simply because they don't fall into the same traps as so many of the Western of dehumanizing. And I've also been rereading the existentialists, a lot of Simone de Beauvoir. And though I don't like it, I just reread Nausea, the Sartre novel.
Have you read The Sisters Brothers?
A while ago, yes. And it's very funny.
I love that. I think it's hysterically funny. And I, you know, you talked before about, you know, wanting to kind of digest the classical genre form so you could change it. And I feel like he's really wonderfully playing with the genre and transmuting it to his own style.
Yeah, that was done also very well by Doctorow in Hard Times, but also, and I'm trying to remember the title of the novel. Robert Coover wrote a Western that I think is perhaps one of my favorite corruptions of the form.
And what's it called, the Coover?
I wish I could remember the title. I want to say it's, for some reason, Ghost Town is jumping into my head, but I don't think that's it.
Well, I'll look it up, because I'm gonna put these on the website with links to find them. And I just want to say, Percival Everett, thank you so much. This was a real honor to get to talk to you, and congratulations on yet another incredibly well-received novel.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Well, that's all from me today. My deepest gratitude goes to Percival Everett for spending time with me for this interview. I won't soon forget it. Also to Meghna Candler for her thoughtful question for Percival. And thanks, as always, to the listeners of this show. You can find links to all the previous episodes on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and always at burnedbybooks.com. Leave a rating for the show at iTunes or Spotify to help me draw more listeners. I'll be dropping new and exciting episodes in the coming weeks, including Joanna Rakoff and Xochitl Gonzalez, and many more. This has been Burned by Books.